Aliyah Muhammad Baker is a librarian in Basra, Iraq. And she likes to tell her patrons that the first thing God said to Muhammad in the Quran was, "Read," which is exactly what you would expect a librarian in Basra, Iraq to say. She was the chief librarian of the central library there in 2003. I read her story in a book called The Librarian of Basra. And that city was one of the first targets for the British and US military preparing the invasion. So she went to the governor to ask if the books could be moved to a safer place, and he flatly denied it, in part because allowing the books to move to safety would be to acknowledge his own time in power was soon coming to an end. She smuggled them out late at night, one trunk load at a time in her car. And when the invasion came, fire from the shelling lit the city at night. The government officials, the soldiers sheltered in the library, manning the anti-aircraft guns set on the roof, they abandoned it. And Aliyah was left alone, her and her library. On the other side of the 7-foot wall that surrounded the grounds of the library is a restaurant, and Aliyah shouted over the wall to the owner, her friend, "Will you help me save the books?" And he pulled out crates from the back room to form makeshift steps partway up the wall, and he took down curtains from the windows, and all night long he and Aliyah and his brothers and their neighbors took books from the shelves, carried them in sacks made of curtains, and handed them over the wall, stacking them in the dining room of the restaurant. 9 days later, the library and all the books that remained burned to the ground. Aliyah knew to keep the books safe, they had to be moved again. They couldn't sit in the restaurant dining room. So in the quiet hours during the 3-week siege of Basra, she hired a truck and took them to her house and the houses of her friends. And she waited for the war to end, dreaming of a new library. If you identify with her, then you will have heard or asked yourself the same questions we could ask Aliyah Muhammad Baker, taking one curtain full of books at a time over the wall. Are you naive? Your country is being invaded. Don't you have better things to do? What do you think you're accomplishing? Who do you think you are? What hope do you possibly have? And why aren't you looking after yourself first? There are at least two ways to answer these questions. And first, she might say, "I did what I could. I made the difference that was within my power to make. We didn't end the money bond system this morning with a collection to the Chicago Common Bond Fund, but we will make a difference to someone who shouldn't be in detention before their trial." In the commentaries of the Jewish Talmud, one rabbi declares, "You're not required to finish your work. You're not required to finish your work. But you're not at liberty to stop doing it either." That is, none of us, you are not called to save the world. Several religions have that covered already. Your work to help heal the world isn't because you have a hope of making a difference for everybody. You don't. We do what we can because we have a hope of making a difference for someone. And that kind of hope is neither pessimism nor optimism. Rebecca Solnit, who you heard in the reading, says, hope is an embrace of the unknown and the unknowable, and an alternative to the certainty of both optimists and pessimists. Optimists think it will be fine without our involvement. Pessimists take the opposite position. Both excuse themselves from acting. Hope, she writes, hope is the belief that what we do matters. Even though how and when it may matter, who and what it may impact are not things we know beforehand. We may not, in fact, know of them afterward either, but they matter all the same. So there's the first answer the librarian of Basra can give to the question of why are you bothering? She can say, I'm going to start where I am and do what I can with what I have. But there's a second kind of answer that the librarian could have given, which is not about hope to make a difference out there in the world. She might have said also, I am doing this because it transforms my own life as much as it transforms the lives of whoever will read these books, because only by acting with a hope for the future do I become a person who believes the future is real. I'm doing this because to survive in the world, to survive, I must be the kind of person who does this. I must not pull the covers over my head and shut my eyes to the reality of what's right in front of me. We're not called to save the world. And we're not called just to do what we can. We're called to be spiritually and ethically healthy, to be people of integrity whose actions match the values we hold. You know the parable of the Good Samaritan? You know this even if you weren't raised Christian, probably. A man robbed and injured on a dangerous road lies in need of help. A priest and a Levite of different social classes pass him by, and a Samaritan, also a social class that would never associate with Jews, stops to help him. This is the equivalent of the white guy who tells his friends, I'm not racist, but pulling over his car and getting out on a side street in Englewood because he sees a black man bleeding on the side of the road. Martin Luther King exegetes, he interprets, explains this passage the day before he dies. He says, I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. Tells me those men were afraid. The Jericho Road is a dangerous road, and it's possible the priest, the Levite, looked over at that man on the ground, wondered if there were robbers still around. Or maybe they felt he was merely faking, acting like he'd been robbed and hurt. And so the first question the priest asked, the first question the Levite asked was, if I do stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by and he reversed the question. He said, if I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? He said, I'm going to do what I can where I am. And I'll add that at the same time the Good Samaritan asks what will happen to him, on some level, I wonder if he also asks, if I do not stop, if I do not stop, what will happen to me? Not what will happen to my body, my safety, my wallet, but what will happen to me if I don't stop? What will happen to the self that I am, the person that I am? How would it be with my soul, if that's your language? What will become of that person I am called to be? Who will I become if I don't stop. Hope is the belief that what we do matters, even though how and when, who and what it may impact are not things we know beforehand. And it's not just something you think. It doesn't live in your head. Hope lives in your hands. It's alive in the way we treat each other. And that's not easy. And sometimes that all looks like foolishness. But hope is a thing in motion. It's not a destination to arrive at, but a becoming, and a becoming as much for yourself as for the world. And it's unclear when you're in the middle of it. Zhu Enlai, the premier of the People's Republic of China under Mao, was asked in the 70s his opinion of the French Revolution. And he reportedly answered, "Too soon to tell." We have hope, but it takes time. This fall, I attended a gathering of Unitarian Universalist ministers and scholars, and they presented an arcane and esoteric cross-section of theology and ethics and biography. It was a gathering of Unitarian nerds. I loved it. I fit right in. One of the presenters was talking about the social gospel, this movement of optimistic Protestantism at the beginning of the 20th century that believed, in the words of Universalist minister Clarence Skinner, we can turn this world into the kingdom of heaven. They were reading the story from the Gospel of Luke, which goes that once, on being asked by the Pharisees when the kingdom of God would come, Jesus replied, "The coming of the kingdom is not something that can be observed, nor will people say, 'Here it is, there it is,' because it exists in your midst." And Skinner and the social gospel read this and said, "We can bring this about with enough earnest effort. We can bring about a sort of utopian community and the end of history." And that optimism, that hope, died in the trenches of European war. But her point, my colleague's point presenting this, was that the hope which died, the hope which Skinner had, was a hope of arrival, that we would reach a fixed destination, that society would be totally transformed, that we would be done, and we could relax. Instead of having to make so many calls to our congressperson about an absolutely unhinged piece of tax legislation that will steal from the poor to give to the rich.
Preach.
Right? What replaced this? What replaced this? Hope for rest, hope for an end, was King's vision of a beloved community. Beloved community, which does not just mean a community you like a lot, beloved pair of slippers, but a community of true humanity and of justice, which is something continually lived into, not arrived at. The hope that something's going to come along and change everything for the better isn't hope, it's optimism. The radicals' dreams of revolution and utopia, I see them photocopied and on light poles in the neighborhood. It's the same kind of apocalyptic hope that we denounce in our fundamentalist neighbors. Nothing worth doing can be accomplished in our lifetime. And we're saved by hope. Our own Dr. Timuel Black, celebrating his 99th birthday with us this morning, I'm going to celebrate in just a few minutes, likes to say that history teaches hope. History teaches hope. And you notice he doesn't say history teaches everything is getting better tomorrow. And he doesn't say the utopian kingdom is coming shortly. He says history teaches hope, not without loss and failure and lamentation. Hope is not a scorecard, but the trust that what we do matters, though we may never know how. If you want hope to survive in the world today, you pray on, teach on, work on, march on, sing on. You love and you ask and give forgiveness. You act from conscience rather than expedience. All those best deep values, which are the stuff of wholeness, this is accessible only in partial and grasping ways, but it is accessible in ordinary time. The writer and theologian Ken Nerburn says, we are not saints. I think you know that already. We're not saints. We're not heroes. Our lives are lived in the quiet corners of the ordinary. We build tiny hearth fires, sometimes barely strong enough to give off warmth. But to the person lost in darkness, our tiny flame may be the road to safety. It's not given to us to know who's lost in the darkness that surrounds us, even if our light is seen. We can only know that against even the smallest of lights, darkness cannot stand. A sailor lost at sea can come home by a single candle. It's not an issue of quality or intensity or purity. It's simply an issue of the presence of light. And living that hope, making it real in our hands and our words and in the world, that's our work to do. May it be so, and amen.